Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for the Root and Roots Show on blogtalkradio.com. Now here's your host, Greg Rashid, bringing you the best in music, information, and history.
Well, I want to say good evening, everyone out there, or whenever you're listening to the show, it might be morning, afternoon, anytime, but this is Greg Rashid, the host of the Root and Roots Show, and you're listening to us live. If you're listening, it's 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Saturday, but if you're listening in on iTunes or especially on KUHS Denver Radio and Television, the originator of that great station, Henry Archuleta, if you're listening to that, you're listening to the show on Wednesday afternoon at 4 p.m., if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, however you listen to the show, at your convenience, I hope you enjoy the show. And this is going to be really unique because we also, by the way, come on Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time live. And this is going to be an interesting show because my guest is calling from Germany. Last week we had a guest, Paul Marco, who called from Ecuador, but he's been in the rotation, so he knows this. But this is a new person. He's a professor. In fact, we are very fortunate because I believe we have him on the line, and we're not even going to do any music. We're just going to get to him. And I want to make sure we have on the line Professor Manfred Berg. Are you there?
I am here.
Oh, I am so honored. And I want to tell my listeners, he's calling at midnight, so I'm not going to keep him on long, like all night, like I do some of the guests. But I'm just happy to have Professor Berg Manfred on here this evening because he has an excellent book. It's not, now, if you're squeamish listeners, I suggest that you not listen to the show because we're going to get kind of graphic with some of the things that Professor Berg has wrote about in the book. And the book is Popular Justice, A History of Lynching in America. And I've been looking forward to talking to you since I got this book like in the early spring. And finally, we're able to connect. I'm so happy to have you on here this evening. And I just want to ask
great
you...
Great to be on your show.
Oh, just thank you so much. And I just want to ask you, first of all, why did you decide to write a book on lynching? There are a lot of books on lynching that are out there, but this one is different, to me at least, because it's very concise. It's not really long, but you cover the whole ground of the history of lynching in America. And just talk about why you decided to do this particular book, and at this time also.
I think that was exactly the reason I wrote it, because when I decided to write it, there was no book on the market that gave a concise history for the general reader from basically the colonial era to the present. And I wanted to write a book that would cover all that ground and be also accessible to general readers, students, just simply everyone interested in the topic.
Well, you've done a superb job with this book.
Thank you.
Not, as I tell my listeners, you can call in at 424-675-8315, 424-675-8315 to talk to Professor Berg. Can I call you Manfred?
Sure.
Is that all right?
Sure.
All right. Talk to Manfred Berg about this book. Popular Justice, History of Lynching in America. Well, first of all, I have so many questions to ask you about the book and just things, but talk about how, you know, in the colonial period, because that's where you really start the whole roots of lynching, how it started, the whole thing of tar and feathering people and this public display of just humiliation and how it grew into actual lynching that we know in the 21st century.
Well, I think a major role played the mob violence during the American Revolution, when mob violence became kind of a standard way to protest British rule. That is one of the sources. Another source is the situation on the colonial frontier, where the public administration of justice was very weak and broke down, and where people thought they had no other choice than taking the law into their own hand. However, I think what is important about keeping in mind about the colonial era is that what we do not see are the gruesome spectacle lynchings that become commonplace in the late 19th and early 20th century. Actually, the term lynching, it originates during the American Revolution. It becomes it enters the American vocabulary in the early 19th century, and it does not really mean that the victims are being killed necessarily. In fact, Colonel Charles Lynch, who was arguably the namesake for the practice, when he held his tribunals against alleged Tories and traitors during the American Revolution, they actually tried to at least preserve kind of a modicum of due process, something that we will simply not see later on.
Right, right, and that, you know, what would possess, well, first of all, the whole mob rule thing and the whole thing of just humiliation during the colonial period gave away to this other form, which is, as we know about, based on the issue of slavery and having Africans brought over here and being punished by lynching. And talk about why, some of it's obvious, obviously, but in the book you really get into why this was a tool to keep Africans in, you know, in line, more or less, to put that in parentheses.
Well, slavery, I think, is certainly one of the root causes of lynching, in the sense that it established the idea in white Americans' minds that Africans were somewhat less than human, that they could be subjected to particularly cruel punishment, that also all whites basically had the right and the duty to control them. Also, I think what played an important role was the authority of the slaveholder to punish slaves at will. So they were, in a sense, removed from the public criminal justice system. However, lynching in the form that you mentioned and that we usually associate with the term today is something, this type of racial lynching becomes extremely widespread in the years after the Civil War, and particularly in the late 19th century. And it had a lot to do with, number one, with the desire of particularly the southern white population to control the liberated around about 4 million former slaves, which they saw as a threat to their status and their economic interest in many ways. Also, obviously, the southern ruling elites had an economic interest in maintaining a pliable labor force. Another aspect, I think, was, and I think most historians would agree, that lynching also ensured and constructed in many ways white solidarity across class divisions at a time when American society, and Southern society in particular, was undergoing enormous transformations.
Right. You know, and that's, you know, I want to skip around a little, but I want to get to one particular lynching that I want you to talk about, the lynching of Henry Smith in Texas, in Paris, Texas, in about 1893. Because that is really in detail, and just describe to my listeners, and listeners, you can call in at 424-675-8315. I'm talking to Manfred Berg, the author of the book Popular Justice, The History of Lynching in America, and he's calling from Germany. So, you know, have some respect, and please, you know, call in if you want to talk to him about the issue. So talk about that particular lynching. What came up, why did that one come about, and what happened afterwards? Because it's really, you know, it's just, All these stories are sad, but that one, that's one of the many that really just got to me.
It's a mind-boggling story. It happened in 1892 in Paris, Texas, when a young African-American man by the name of Henry Smith had supposedly killed the young daughter of the local sheriff in Paris, Texas, and a posse hunted him down. They caught him near the Arkansas border, actually I think in Arkansas, and then brought him back on the train, and it was kind of everyone knew that there would be a lynching in Paris, Texas. There were huge crowds, allegedly. There were 10,000 onlookers. Actually, a lot of people from the vicinity of Paris actually boarded the train on which the posse brought back the unfortunate Henry Smith. And when he came to Texas, to Paris, Texas, a scaffold had already been erected with somewhat facetiously, one might almost say, having the words justice painted on the scaffold, and then Henry Smith was tortured to death. I really spare your listeners the gruesome details. He was cut into pieces. People, onlookers afterwards, would scavenge for his body parts as souvenirs. And of course,
if I could put you, I want you to stop right there, because that's not because of what you're saying, but I want to talk to you more about that, because you say it in the book. And this is something I've known for a long time, but you really get into this, because I remember stories from the 70s when I was in college in the 80s where there would be these stories where people would go into the homes, especially in the South, of seniors who had died who were in the 80s and 90s, and they would find many times a foot or a toe or, you know, a finger in a drawer somewhere, and they found out that was actually an African-American's body part. And I want you to talk about why that was done. And one thing you mentioned in there is that the whole thing about people wanting to buy these parts.
It is indeed unbelievable from our perspective. It is so gory and gruesome that we can hardly stomach it. But apparently at the time, it was seen, I would almost call it a trophy. It was lynching, particularly these spectacle lynchings, as it happened in Paris, Texas, and in other places, served the function of being sort of public rituals that strengthened the cohesion of the white community in a way by looking at these gruesome scenes, by participating in it at least symbolically, and by scavenging these body parts, people became in a way asserted their membership in the quote-unquote moral community that had meted out the justice they saw fit. I think it is very important to point out that very few lynchers had any moral qualms about what they were doing. There was no such thing as regret or remorse.
And I want to ask you about that, because you say it in a sentence like these are like upstanding citizens of the community, churchgoers, you know, the business folk, you know, the country store owners, just average school teachers who would be considered ordinarily the friendliest people you can meet. But in this instance, they forget all of that. And they can, you know, and you don't explain this. And I was wondering if you've ever thought about what would possess a person who's this very faithful person to one minute slice off another human being's parts and lynch him and all, and then the next day go to church and pray about forgiveness and all, and have no problem with that.
I think people act very differently when they act as individuals and when they act in crowds. And when They act in crowds where they feel they are part of a larger force that does the right thing, that relieves them of moral doubt and of any moral doubt that they might have. Another thing is, I think American lynchers historically are not exceptional. I think we would be mistaken if we assumed that the terrible things that happen in history, that they are perpetrated by perverts and somewhat distorted people for the most part. For the most part, it's actually ordinary men, and in the case of lynching, it's usually men who perpetrate these type of things, although women do play a role. But nevertheless, when, for example, you look at the members of Nazi execution squads, these were, in a way, ordinary people. And to some extent, they believed in it, just like American lynchers in the age of Jim Crow believed that they had to protect the white race from the quote-unquote black beast. So ideology, that is to say racism, played a key role, I would argue. But it also had a lot to do with the fact that as an individual, you would never be held accountable. You could expect to work you could expect to act with impunity. That is another aspect.
You know, and it's just the idea, you know, and looking at the pictures, not only in your book, but seeing pictures of folks gathered after lynching, you know, white folks, and they're just smiling. Just, you know, just happy and gleeful.
They believed they seriously believed they did the right thing. It was a spectacle. Also, I think some historians, and I think with good reasons, have argued that lynchings as spectacles were kind of a mass entertainment. There is a famous line by a contemporary journalist from Baltimore, Henry Louis Mencken, who once said that what the South really needed was better entertainment, so they would not have to. It was, of course, very acerbic and very ironical the way he expressed it. But he said, well, this is such a culturally deserted place. They just need better entertainment. Give them theaters and circuses and whatever so they don't have to lynch.
Well, it was more than that, obviously.
I think there's part of it, certainly, there's more than just a kernel of truth in it. I think it is, indeed, these spectacle lynchings, as you mentioned, if you look at these people, it was, in a way, it was entertainment, in a way that public executions were entertainment. In my book, I make a very strong argument that lynching and the death penalty
have a common history. Yes, and talk about that some more, that whole common history of the death penalty, because, that's a very important point you brought up in the book.
When we go back to the colonial era, what we see is that the death penalty is kind of a communal ritual that is carried out by, the villagers or the people of a county. It's held publicly. You have sermons. You have kind of a sort of a restoration. It is often seen as the restoration of a moral order that had been violated by the condemned. Now, with the rise of the modern criminal justice system, the state, in a way, claims a monopoly of punishing criminals, and as I and other historians argue, lynching can also be interpreted as a rebellion against this claim to monopoly of legitimate violence and punishment on the part of the state. And I think that is a feature that is very pronounced in American culture, the distrust of government. So that is one part, I think. The other part that I think is very important to mention is that lynching declines from the 1890s onward, and it does so for two reasons. One reason is that, and we do not really know why that happens, but that from around 1915, 1920 onward, and the local police, the local sheriffs who would often collude with the mob, they become more inclined to defend their prisoners, to haul them away for safekeeping, and so sort of the police becomes more active in fighting mob action. The other part of the story, and I think a very important part of the story, is that what we see is a rise in executions, particularly of African Americans, being being condemned and executed for alleged rape. So in a way,
At least
for some time, it becomes the substitute for lynching. This is what I argue, and I found almost unbelievable evidence of really mock trials, of trials that were a travesty of justice, you might call it, when it was perfectly clear, when the mob was already in the courtroom, when defendants would be executed right after the jury had brought out the guilty verdict. All of this had nothing to do with even a modicum of due process, but allegedly those were official executions that did not count as lynchings.
Right. A third component, which actually you say in the book, in a sense, is folks like Ida B. Wells, the NAACP at that time, putting pressure on the government by releasing, especially Ida B. Wells, releasing these papers, documents, books about lynching that no one else was even dealing with at the time. And I just feel that did a lot to just kind of stop things for a while.
Well, it certainly played. I agree that it certainly played a role, and we really have to acknowledge the courage and the resilience of Ida B. Wells and other people, and the NAACP in particular, in fighting lynch law. But what we have to keep in mind is that they really had to fight an uphill battle for a number of reasons. Many Americans believed that, and that was true in the North as well as in the South, many white Americans believed in the rape myth. Even people such as, say, President Theodore Roosevelt, they would publicly condemn lynching, but they would at the same time say, but lynching is, you know, the reason why lynchings happen is that there's so many rapes of white women by black men, and the blacks have to stop it themselves. So there is this assumption, and Ida B. Wells is one of the most courageous acts that she actually comes out with in the 1890s, is to say, wait a minute, all of this is a myth, and it often covers up consensual relationships. She herself has to leave the South after this, because she would have certainly had to face a
oh yeah, they were after her,
a lynch mob.
It
was a tough uphill battle. It was also that the federal government, for many years, including the U.S. Supreme Court, including majorities in Congress, including the White House, would argue, well, you know, criminal justice is state law. This is a prerogative of the states. We can't do anything about it. And although several states passed so-called anti-lynching laws, it was for a fairly long time, they didn't do anything about it. So it was a tough uphill battle, and I think it it had some, it gained traction, particularly in the 1930s with the New Deal and when more broad-based interracial coalitions became possible. But we should keep in mind that the Southern white congressmen and senators in particular retained a veto power in the Senate and for a long, long time.
Yes, they did. And there's one other thing that you don't bring up in the book, but I had an author, another professor on a number of years ago. Her name is Carintha Mitchell, and she's based at The Ohio State University. She wrote a book called, and she's African-American woman. She wrote a book called Living with Lynching. And she talks about how there were many African-Americans, playwrights at the turn of the 20th century, that would write plays about lynching where it showed that there was a component of the African-American community at that time who were opposed to lynching, but on the other hand, it's like what you were saying earlier about rape, that some people say, well, these folks deserve to be lynched because they're supposedly rapists. Her thing was that she found out there were some folks that were African-Americans that were opposed to lynching, but there were some who felt, well, we do have some evil people among us, and they may have deserved that.
Well, that is interesting. This is actually the assumption with which Ida B. Wells herself starts when she writes in The Red Record and everything. She writes about her own experience. And then she finds out, then what happens is that three of her friends are lynched in Memphis, Tennessee, in the early 1890s. And these friends of hers, the successful black businessmen, and they get lynched because their white competitors stir up a mob against them. And then Wells comes to see through the idea that through the whole mythology and the hysteria about rape and about this obsession with black and white sexuality that really is, as one historian once aptly called it, the folk pornography of the Bible Belt, in these years. It is quite reasonable to assume that these ideas were also rooted within the black community. There's also an aspect, I briefly mentioned it in my book, there are also lynchings in the South when black communities lynch black criminals. In part,
right,
because they, in part because they argue that they can get no justice from the white criminal justice system that simply doesn't care about black-on-black crime. So they say, and this is the classical argument of lynch lawyers, we have to take the law into our own hand because it's inefficient, it is weak, it doesn't really mete out the type of punishment that we see fit. So I would agree that on the one hand that African Americans hold some of these views themselves, but on the other hand, I would assume that blacks living in the Jim Crow South, they also had to put on a mask. They couldn't really take issue with sort of the dominant white discourse. And they knew quite well that every, particularly African-American man who stepped out of line or came perilously close to being suspected of having approached a white woman was in outright danger.
And it still goes on. I want to get to the current issue as far as the other forms of lynching, but I want to ask you about something in your book that I had never really seen in writing before, but you talk about the whole aspect of Mexican Americans being lynched, and that's something no one talks about. And talk about that.
Well, to be fair, I have to give credit to several colleagues, Professor Webb in England and Professor Kerrigan at Rowan University, whose work I'm using and with whom I've collaborated. And they've written really a great book about the lynching of Mexicans, and they have found out that on a per capita basis, Mexicans in the Southwest after the annexation of what was before Mexican territory had as high a risk of being lynched as African Americans in the South. And what we see here is, on the one hand, their racial issues, of course, although they're in many ways different from the South. But it also has to do with the desire of Anglo-Americans to consolidate their rule in a territory that had belonged to the Mexicans. And so in a way, it's comparable to what happens in the South after Reconstruction. It's an extreme instrument of social control. The Mexicans, of course, fight back. They can go across the border, and there's a lot of guerrilla fighting going on, and with atrocities on both sides.
Right. And that's, you know, I have to get a hold of the books that you were mentioning, because I really like to get into that issue more, because a lot of the folks that listen to this show are based in the Southwest, in particular Colorado, where I've lived for the past 20 years, and they will be fascinated to know that. You know, it's a part of history that is not really taught in the schools out there, I can say in Colorado, in New Mexico, where a lot of these lynchings happened in New Mexico, and it would be fascinating, you know, just to get those professors on also eventually and talk about that, because it's really a forgotten subject. It is, you know, it's mainly black and white in this country as far as the issue of lynching, but there is this other segment with the Mexican-American community that's completely forgotten and ignored. So I'm just thankful that you brought it up and the other folks that you mentioned have brought that up, too.
Yeah, they've entitled their book The Forgotten Dead, and I think that's an apt title.
The Forgotten Dead. I will work on getting those folks on here, because that's a very important component. Now, let's fast forward now to today, because you mentioned, and it keeps coming across in the book about taking the law in your own hand. Now, you don't mention in this book, because I guess this book was published before the old issue of Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman happened.
Oh, yeah.
But I want you to talk about that. Go ahead.
I think, it was published in 2011, so before the Trayvon Martin killing. But I mention another case at the end of the book that happened in 2006 in Pasadena, Texas, aroused a lot of attention, also internationally. And the point that I'm trying to make is, although these incidents were not classical lynchings, they nevertheless are in a certain, or should be seen in a certain tradition here, because what they epitomize and mirror is a widespread belief in American culture that individuals or groups have the right to take the law into their own hands if they see fit. And this kind of sort of this vigilante tradition, as it has rightly been called, is something that is in fact very unique to the United States, at least among the major industrialized nations. And I think President Obama very recently pointed this out after the shootings in Oregon. It has to do with the easy, almost unlimited access to firearms. It has to do with the so-called stand-your-ground laws that tolerate a very extensive notion of legitimate self-defense, and I know how difficult. I've lived for a long time in the United States. I'm a frequent visitor. I know what a contentious issue that is and how difficult it is to speak with people who are just infatuated with the idea that an upright citizen has to own a gun and should use it whenever he or his family is attacked. But my point is the United States has a murder rate or a homicide rate that is between 5 and 10 times higher than in Europe, and I think there must be reasons for that.
Yeah, definitely so. And, you know, as you were saying earlier, and I could go on with you all. Now, I'm just, first of all, Matthew, I'm just grateful. I mean, Manfred, I'm so grateful that you spent all this time because I thought we were going to do maybe 10 minutes. And I'm just so grateful you've done this. But I'm going to be concluding this because the book, I don't want to give away a lot in this book. This book, first of all, should be in all history classes in this country, in universities, in high schools, because it's very, you know, it's just a part of the history. And as you say in the book, how there are so many people who don't want to, it doesn't matter what race, they want to forget that these lynchings ever happened. Meanwhile, you have issues like, yeah, go ahead, as you were about to say.
Yeah, that is true. And I mean, I come from a country where, and I've grown up in a country where people wanted to forget about terrible history too. But it comes back to haunt you. It comes back to haunt you at some point, and as I mentioned at the end of my book, there have been attempts, particularly the very valuable exhibition by Mr. Allen on Without Sanctuary that alerted and created a broader consciousness. But it is interesting that if you look at the historians, after lynching ceased as a public spectacle in the mid-20th century, there were no books on lynching for virtually 3 decades. And then,
that's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. Now, since for the past 15, 20 years, we have almost a cottage industry in the field, so there is a growing awareness, and I hope that my little book has made a small contribution to raising that awareness. But I think it's still a painful and difficult topic, and a lot of people would prefer to forget about it.
But then again, as you were saying, too, they want to forget about it, but the things you mentioned at the beginning of our discussion, and you say in the book about how, in particular, African-Americans have been perceived as these overly sex-threatening animals, it comes back in the 21st century with the, and I have to go back to Trayvon Martin, you have to go back to a number of the police killings that have happened in the past year and a half in this country where the descriptions of the victims, those that died, was as someone that was almost like a beast. That Trayvon Martin was portrayed as someone who was bigger than he was, this brute, this strong this individual. You know, the young man that died, Michael Brown, that died in Ferguson, the same thing. He was portrayed as this giant. And you see that, you know, when you look at the history of lynching and you see how the folks who were lynched, how they were described as these brutes, as these huge animals, as these, you know, something that has to be gotten rid of. So, unfortunately,
yeah, there is a continuity in images and stereotypes that is still very powerful, and that needs to be addressed.
Right.
I think that is, it's more than obvious. There is the notion that somehow young black men are innately dangerous and that they need to be controlled, and that the police should have very broad discretion in dealing with them. And there is, I shouldn't, perhaps it's be interesting for your readers, for the listeners to learn that there are perhaps round about 650 people killed every year by police in the United States, in a country such as Germany, which has 80 million residents, the number has never been higher than 5 to 10 in any year for the past 20 years. So there's something wrong with the American police as well. I appreciate that they're often in danger, that America is the best armed civilian population in the world. There's no question about it. So, but nevertheless, there is a certain problem there that I think ought to be addressed.
Yes, certainly is. And Manfred, we could go on with this, but I just want to thank you for the time. And if anyone wants to get a hold of you, do you have a website?
Yes, I do. I do. You should just need to Google my name, Manfred Berg Heidelberg, and then I teach at Heidelberg University in Germany, and then you will find it's also an English version of the website, and you can just write me an email, and I'll be happy to respond.
And I'm just happy to have you on here this evening. And last week we had someone from Ecuador, so we're getting in. This show is becoming international now. And have someone
That's
from
it.
Germany, and it's really great. I really appreciate that, and I hope that. Are you going to continue for your next studies, next books on lynching, or are you going to do something completely different?
I'm currently doing something completely different. I'm writing a biography of President Woodrow Wilson. So,
lynching, the whole issue of lynching comes about.
Play some part in it. I draw on my research.
Oh, that's fascinating. Cool. That is something. Well, Manfred, I just want to thank you for coming on today. I look forward maybe sometime one of us across the Atlantic and we can meet each other. But I really am grateful for you writing this book and grateful for you doing this interview today. It's what, like 1 o'clock in the morning now.
Great talking to you, and it's great being on your program, and I hope your listeners enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Oh, I'm sure they. What happens usually is people get back with me after these shows, because a lot of them are downloaded for later on, and they just tell me that they want to get these books, they want to meet the authors, all of this. So it's, it's really, this is one of the better interviews I've had, honestly, because it's a very important subject.
Thank you so much.
Well,
and thanks for the praise for the book. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. You take care. And again, that was Professor Manfred Berg, the author of the book Popular Justice, A History of Lynching in America. It's on Roman and Littlefield Press in the U.S. And it's a short book. It's really short, but it's concise as far as it gets into the whole history of lynching in this country. And I hope, I urge you to go get this book. If you want to learn the history, it is graphic. It is very graphic in some instances, but we're talking about lynching. We're not talking about, baseball. We're talking about something that's really, this is terrible. So I hope you enjoyed that interview, and I'm going to play it right now. Billie Holiday, Strange Fruit, because this is a song that she wrote talking about lynching back in the 40s on the Root and Root Show.